Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This September 1st, 2015 edition, episode 53 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from a few locations. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song and contribution, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This week we'll have a climate change update, a Doomer of the Week, and our guest interview, but we begin with something from Guy. Guy?
Hey, thanks, Mike. I was at coffee today. I go to coffee just about every Tuesday morning with several of the neighbors. There were a dozen people there today, and the owner of the house where we have this coffee club died about 48 hours ago. And a dozen people showed up anyway, including his youngest son, Lynn. And I hadn't met his son before, neither had most of the folks there. He was just coming out to visit his dad, and then when he was en route, his dad was put into hospice. And so it was really quite wonderful because we told stories about Frank and his influence on our lives, and what a wonderful, generous, caring person he was. And then Steve, who frequently asked people when they're leaving, as if to imply, you know, that they should be out of here pretty soon, turns to Lynn and wonders how long Lynn is going to stay on this trip now that his work is about done here. So he says to Lynn, "So when are you going to be getting out of here?" And Lynn, without even batting an eye, says, "Well, my dad was 98 and I'm 58, so I think I have a little bit more time." I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah.
Sort of reminded me of Mike, my wife, and I meeting today's guest about 10 days ago at a book signing and reading event in Tucson.
Yes, our guest today is Stephen Jenkinson, and he is a teacher, author, storyteller, spiritual activist, farmer, and founder of the Orphan Wisdom School, a teaching house and learning house for skills of deep living and making human culture. It's rooted in knowing history, being claimed by ancestry, and working for a time yet to come. With master's degrees from Harvard University in theology and the University of Toronto in social work, apprenticed to a master storyteller, he has worked extensively with dying people and their families. He's a former program director in a major Canadian hospital, former assistant professor in a prominent Canadian medical school, consultant to palliative care and hospice organizations, and educator and advocate in the helping professions. He is also a sculptor, traditional canoe builder, whose house won a Governor General's Award for Architecture. Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul, is Jenkinson's March 2015 book about grief and dying and the great love of life. It was published by North Atlantic Books, and it is his fourth book. Stephen was featured in the 2008 documentary film Griefwalker, and you can find much more information about Stephen at his website, orphanwisdom.com. Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network, Stephen Jenkinson.
You know, I think you just introduced me. I can't barely hear a word.
Okay. Let's see if
so we're going to have to turn it way up or start again, or I don't know what you want to do.
Okay. How about now?
We'll try to speak loudly. This reminds me of being at coffee with people who are all about 20 to 40 years older than me.
Oh, yeah? Well, I don't know which of us is the older one here, but I still can't hear you.
Okay.
Okay. Let's see if the studio can jack it up. Maybe if I I don't know if it's me if I remove my headphones. Let's see if that doesn't. Does that improve the sound quality or anything? Testing on the sound quality.
Steven, can you hear me?
Oh, much better now.
How about
okay.
me?
Good. I think we solved that problem.
Okay. No, that was going to be impossible. I was going to have to, you know, read semaphore as to what you said.
Mike, do you want to start us off with a question, if you're still there?
I don't know. Can he hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay,
there
excellent.
There you go.
I was reading Die Wise on the plane, and I wanted to start off with a poem from page 6 and then and talk a little bit and start from there. And the poem reads, "What if those people could stand on the shore watching their wake wash a bit of the shore away? And what if each of us could stay put long enough to see the rippling trail of everything we did rolling out behind us? What if we stopped long enough to see the long train of unintended consequences span out from every innocently intended thing we did?" Guy and I talk a lot about abrupt climate change and human consequences and ultimately extinction events, and I thought this was a fitting way to start. And we talk a lot about the dominant culture. And when we talk about the dominant culture, we talk about it in terms that it's civilization. In your work, you talk about the dominant North American culture. And I was wondering, based on this poem, if you could tell us a little bit what you mean by the dominant North American culture.
Sure. Well, probably I didn't even choose a good enough phrase for what I meant even with that one. So let me change it again and say, I think we would do well to reserve the word culture for a kind of achieved something, not mm-hmm. a kind of inevitable something or the debris that accumulates as a consequence of something, but really a kind of a singular achievement that could be might be recognizable in this fashion, that really cultured people decide that they're driving along the highway, the road, the sign by the side of the road says highway improvements in progress, and for a change it means they're tearing up the road and planting wildflowers.
Okay.
In other words, I think the word culture should be an indication that people have found a way to live some kind of blood oath partnership with the place that has agreed to have them, and that when we decide that when our presence on the scene or our way of being ourselves somehow throws that partnership terribly out of balance, that we just decide to stop, and in particular to stop growing. Oh God, imagine that. And that would be a culture, it seems to me, that it's always the consequences of the culture's behavior are never far away.
Mm-hmm.
What we have is something instead of a culture. Maybe you could say that in North America, we never really had a chance because we went somehow from, you know, to use de Tocqueville's line, from frontierism to barbarism without passing through the intermediate stage, you know, of culture.
Right.
I think he used the word civilization, but you know, this is principally what's missing. A real sense, an enduring sense of consequence seems to be one of the principal casualties of our way of doing things. And you could, from that, you know, I noticed it when I worked in the death trade for years. I noticed that people's, you know, kind of remarkable insistence on dying exactly the way it suited them, which generally was not to die at all while they were dying. They never imagined that there'd be any consequence that would accrue to anyone or any other time other than themselves, you know, such as the utter self-absorption of our age, really, a sure sign that we've thrown every aspect of initiation out the window in favor of self-actualization. And, well, we have personal style instead of obedience, I would say, as a kind of thumbprint of our way of doing things. And then finally, the other thing I'd mention is, someone said to me, oh, a year or so ago, you've heard that they've come up with a new name for our era. What's that? I said, oh, they said, it's the Anthropocene. Well, I know enough about Greek etymology to recognize the word. Basically, a human wrought and human-centered creation is right. What we find ourselves in the middle of now, meaning we can't really take two steps away from anything that we've done without taking another step towards something else we've done. And the irony of that whole arrangement is the more inescapable the human presence in our world is, the lonelier it seems that we've become.
Yeah, you used the word arrangement instead of culture. I think that's good. Maybe what we live in is a living arrangement instead of a culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned that you said that if you have your feet planted firmly in this life, you don't need anyone to tell you you're dying. Do you think that's true for our living arrangement as well?
Completely. You know, I've appeared on many programs in the last 8 months or so that are ostensibly devoted to consideration of, you know, things related to climate change and mm-hmm. extinction, as you said, and so on. And, you know, whenever I've done things in the presence of an audience that are ostensibly about those things, there are a few people who will always walk out because they say, you know, I came here to learn about climate change. Well, look, right. Don't come to me to learn about climate change. You know, what do I know? I'm living the consequences of it, but I pretend to be no expert, and I'm not sure that that kind of expertise is overly necessary. The whole thing's accelerating, and the experts of 5 years ago have, you know, across the board found themselves to be playing catch-up to their own predictions 5 years later. So it's the same thing. The idea that we hand over our conscience to people who claim either superior knowledge or to be in charge or, you know, politically controlling the situation and so on is, well, we get what we bargain for by doing such a thing. And it's whether it's your personal dying, which is really, it's not even reading tea leaves. It's just having your face in the wind of your own days. I mean, this is not beyond you to know when you're in your dying time. You certainly don't need an MRI to tell you. But the whole issue is you have an MRI because this is an unwelcome proposition and not because it's not approachable.
Right.
Let me go back to that. In fact, we spend a lot of time in this living arrangement fearing death and perhaps even more universally ignoring death. Woody Allen famously said, I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Yeah.
To the contrary, you often say that one has to love the end. Can you explain that, loving the end?
Yeah, maybe I... Okay, let's go with the fact that I might have said that. I'll try to catch up to it. I think what I meant by that is something in this area. How do you... You know, they made this film, Grief Walker, and it's consistently introduced, when I'm there at least, as a film about dying and about death, which, frankly, it is not. That's not the subject of it. It certainly passes through the vapor trail of dying and death, particularly as it's as the overwrought version that we've come up with, yes. But for all of that, that's not the focus. That's not the purpose. The purpose of the film is more meditative and less argumentative, I think. And the meditation is on the following. What does it take to fall in love with being alive? And I really chose that language deliberately. Fall in love doesn't really mean cope, you know? If you try to cope at home, well, I would just leave it at that. So the idea that you can fall in love with being alive is something. It's like not one lifestyle option amongst many. I think it's basically what's asked of us as a consequence of this remarkable gift of being able to walk around and have most of your parts work, you know, for at least a while. It's an astounding thing. If you look at your foot, for example, the thing is so unlikely. There's so many bones down there, and how does that work is, you know, God only knows. But the fact that we have two of them, most of us, and then we get to walk around in them at least for a while is astounding. So it seems love... You know, to be loved, to be almost drunk with adoration over that possibility, is a mandatory prerequisite. How do you get there, though? If your feet are working all the time, do you even notice them? Okay, usually you don't. So what does it take? I think what it takes is being willing to glimpse the end of everything that you hold dear, not just your feet, but but really every shoreline that you hold dear is in the process of, you know, turning into something else. Every stream that comes down off the mountain that goes through your farm is going to end up either not being a stream at all, the way things are going now, probably won't be. And if you bring kids into the world, you have a good look at them sometimes and recognize what you did to them by being in on their creation, is that you put their feet on the path, the inevitable path and the merciful path of their own death, which who really considers this at procreation time or 9 months later or at any time? Right. So the point of this whole thing is to say, really, love is what you have instead of faith. Faith is it's almost outlived its day, it seems to me. The idea that if you believe strongly enough that something good will ensue, I don't think so. I think what love is doesn't require any faith whatsoever. It doesn't require another 5 minutes of what you love in order to love it. That's hope and that's faith and so on. Love is a kind of a singular human-scaled mysterious achievement that finds a way to say amen without understanding everything and without benefiting from it necessarily. That's in the neighborhood of what I meant by all those things. The willingness to see the end of everything you hold dear is what confers upon you some skillfulness where that loving is concerned.
Right. You say not success, not growth, not happiness. The cradle of your love of life is death.
Is death, right.
And so can you begin to explain how
I'm
someone
have to interrupt
in
again.
A
I can barely hear you again.
Culture can begin to grasp that?
Can you hear me a little bit better, Stephen?
Slightly better.
Okay, I think Mike was asking, you know, your quote, not success, not growth, not happiness, the cradle of your love of life is death.
Right.
Can you explain how one can begin to grasp this in a culture, a set of living arrangements that is completely phobic about death?
Yeah. The answer is you probably can't. I mean, the odds are against it, right? Your question testifies faithfully to the circumstances at hand. How can we do so when we are, you know, breastfed by a death-phobic culture? The answer is the odds aren't good. So, first of all, before we even talk about the content of your question, the dynamic requires something in the order of a kind of really stout and really energetic kind of labor, because you got to work your way through these things that do not testify to their death-phobic quality. But they are legion, I'm telling you. And hope would be a very good example of a death-phobic culture's prescription for its own terror. That's what hope is, and basically that's what palliative care is. So that comment, I think it's derived from the Grief Walker film. The phrase, I think, was the cradle of your love of life. That's a very deliberately chosen word there, cradle. Cradle means not really creation, more like that's the home in the early days of considering these things in an uncommon fashion. You could say you come to these things in those days, much as a child would, you know, trying to consider the mystery of the sun and the moon, or, you know, where does the light go at night, or, you know, things of that kind. Kind of the ordinary scale mysteries that we just simply grow accustomed to.
Right.
You know, dying is one of those things. It just never emerges on the radar in a death-phobic culture. So the idea that the cradle of your love of life, it means, again, it's kind of harkens back to the previous question, that the ability to love being alive is not an inevitable consequence of having breath, or having a mind, or having self-consciousness, or sentience. None of these things inevitably result in us being being overwhelmed with gratitude, you see. So the next thing you realize is, really, we traffic in inevitability pretty frequently. I hear it all the time. Here's a good one. Well, there's two things that are certain in life, and you know what the quote is. Well, I don't know about the tax part, but I can tell you this. There's nothing inevitable about dying. Now, right now, most people have hung up on me. But wait, what I mean by that is this. If you think that dying is simply a metabolic, you know, physical, medical, measurable event, if that's what it is to you, I suppose the anemic phrase that dying is inevitable, you win. If, on the other hand, dying is largely a kind of choreographed minuet that you dance with what has been granted to you, whether it's 7 years or 70 or something in between, and you proceeded many years as if this would never really end, at least until you agreed, and now you find it that it's ending whether you agree or whether you don't, the way that you die, you see, your manner of dying, what you bring to it, that's your dying. That's not what you do about dying. That's actually your dying. In other words, it's not what your body does as a consequence of cancer or a car accident. It's what you do as a consequence of cancer or a car accident or the death-phobic culture that has reared you from infancy, whispering in your ear that there's always plan B. I'll give you a very, very simple way of reckoning this. The verb to die in the English language, it cannot be used in the passive voice in proper English, in grammatically correct English. And if you just think about what that means, I mean, we diminish the English language as a kind of mutt, which God knows it is, but look at the genius that's buried right in the architecture of our grammar, that you can't use the verb to die passively. It's always active, which means when you're speaking English, at least, dying is what you do. It's not what happens to you.
Right.
That you're not on the receiving end of your own dying. You are, rather, on the doing end, the crafting end, the performing end. And all of this confers upon each of us an immense kind of responsibility to get it right. And the way to do that, in my humble opinion, is get started, man. There's nothing to wait for. A terminal diagnosis, a shudder in your bones, none of these things are required. That's what I mean by the cradle of your love of life. If you take that understanding and extrapolate it beyond your personal demise to think in terms of, you know, this thing that we have instead of a culture, which, I mean, if you're willing to know it, you could pretty much say that it's kind of run its course. We've been heavy users. We've basically ignored the cumulative consequence of the debt that we're racking up by how we live. We're willing to pass it on, you know, to the generations to come without much hesitation. All of these things, basically, there's no sign that they're going to be able to continue so very, very much longer. I don't know what that's going to look like. Do I think that humans will be alive on the other side of that? Yes, I probably think that they will, some of us. But most of what we hold dear right now probably won't. Well, then you take the same understanding about personal dying and apply it as a kind of orphan wisdom to this larger scale passing away of things, this larger scale dying off of what could not continue. And I submit to you, it asks the same degree of obedience and willingness to see and willingness to cultivate a kind of very daring kind of love for a kind of human life and way of life that probably won't last a whole lot longer. Love doesn't mean try to make sure it doesn't die. Love means as if your mom was dying. What does it ask of you? It asks that you learn it. It doesn't ask that you go away and have somebody phone you when it's done. It's the same with this sort of larger scale things that are in the offering now. That I think it's really behooves us now not to blink, and stop, you know, stop stocking up on beans and bullets, as my Texas friend says that people are doing in Texas and elsewhere.
Yeah. You've indicated there again that most people take a lot for granted, including the ability to walk and breathe and immerse oneself in this, whatever this is, whatever passes for culture. Mm-hmm. For the most part, in similar manner, people view hope as irredeemably good.
Sure.
And you've mentioned that hope is actually a four-letter word. Will you unpack that a little bit for us?
Yes. It's such a counterintuitive idea, no? But, I'll start with a kind of a disturbance in the form of a declaration. If this culture is death-phobic, and I'm utterly persuaded it is, then, you know, death-phobic places and peoples and cultures are kind of like a junkie. They're like a crackhead. And a crackhead, it's not lost on the crackhead that the crackhead is a problem. But every solution that the crackhead comes up with is designed to maintain the crack dependency without exception. Every solution is finding a way to do the right thing and maintain the addiction. This is exactly what you have in a death-phobic culture. One of the hallmarks, it seems to me, of the culture that I was born into is something I've come to call competence addiction. A very strange phrase, because just like hope, competence is supposed to be inherently good for you and good for everyone else around you. But it's an extremely intolerant, it's a kind of apartheid of the soul, that you disown the parts of you that aren't functioning at 100%. We refer to them as baggage. You've heard the phrase 100 times as I have. And is this not at least as true and venerable part of you as the part that you're proud of? And then you extend the same apartheid to your ancestry. And so what do we claim? If we claim any ancestry at all, it's the honorable one, the one you'd want to be from. And then if you come to hope, then hope seems to be some kind of insane prerequisite for proceeding. Well, this is a prescription written by a junkie to solve his addiction. You see, so how does hope actually function? Well, it varies. It functions exactly like a mortgage does, in that it's prone and facing the future. It's concerned about the future. It relies on the future to legitimize anything that might be happening right now, or it legitimizes as long as there's a future to consider. Then we can put up with X, Y, and Z now. Sounds a lot like the heaven rap to me, you see. So the best rendering I've ever heard that contends well with this is a book title by Samuel Beckett. And, of course, as an Irishman, of course he'd confound things just with his title. The name of the book is I Can't Go On, I'll Go On. All one phrase, no punctuation, no pauses in there at all. And there's also no conjunctions. He doesn't say, I can't go on, but I'll go on, or still I'll go on, or yet I'll go on. Because in his rendering of that title, he's not saying that these two things are either opposites or intolerant of each other or impossible to carry together from one moment to the next. In fact, he's saying, I can't go on is sometimes utterly and completely true. It's not a failure of the imagination when you can't go on. It's an absolutely accurate portrayal of the current regime. And the rest of the book title says, I'll go on, and you could render that slightly differently and maybe a little more legibly by saying, I'll go on not being able to. Yeah. You see? These the only sound contradictory, but they're both skills. The first one, I can't go on, is the skill of being wrecked on schedule, my phrase. And the other skill of going on, you know, hope-free, not being able to, is a separate but allied skill. These two things together will hold us in very good stead, I think, in the coming decades.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're speaking with Stephen Jenkinson, author of Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. Stephen, you said our children deserve less, considerably less, than their parents had. And I think it seems to me that maybe if we were less concerned about giving them things, stuff, so to speak, and more about building this skill set you talk about, we'd be a little better off. It seems like we're in constant negotiations with the unnegotiable. And so I really enjoyed that quote. Our children deserve less, considerably less, than their parents had. I was wondering if you could kind of expand upon that.
Yeah, that came to me. Someone I know was, found himself taking work, pure work that he didn't necessarily believe in, because he felt, enormously responsible to the people at home. Completely understandable and honorable as far as it goes. But you know what Hunter S. Thompson said: when the going gets tough, the pros turn weird. And this is not a bad marching orders for at least some of us, as these days unfold. So I was thinking as he was saying this, because this is a unassailable reality if you leave it alone. Yeah. Mike, I got to do this because I got to provide. But then the question is, provide what? Well, the necessities. Hold on a second. You start wondering what constitutes necessity these days, and you're gonna come screeching to a halt, and you wish you weren't. Because the things that pass for necessary among us are basically a consequence of this kind of hope addiction, this positivism that I was talking about earlier. So the idea for your kids deserve all these, quote, possibilities. I mean, I like what you said a second ago. We're constantly trying to negotiate with the non-negotiable. So what's so magical about all these possibilities when you're only going to end up doing one or two of them? Why do you have to have 17 or 24? Doesn't that sound like a mall? Isn't that kind of some kind of inner mall that we all imagine that as long as we can go to it, then we don't have to? As long as it's open, then somehow we derive some kind of reassurance, that things can be. I could. And we seem to be in the business of, whatever else, do not frustrate your kid's desire for more. This seems to be bedrock so-called family value these days. And it's obviously doing nobody no good. You could even go further and say maybe the state that we find ourselves in is a consequence of that kind of depression era, or even immigrant mentality that says that, I didn't come here so my kid can learn, hide tanning and live in the woods with an outdoor toilet, That's right. What we were doing back in the old country. So it's the same kind of madness that somehow the following generation should only benefit from the successes of the generation that preceded it, and whatever consequences there are for those successes should somehow, stay in the background or never be passed on. But as you said so wisely, that's a non-negotiable arrangement, meaning whatever we imagine that we're pulling off and bestowing by way of what we intend to bestow to the generations to come, the costs of pursuing that and achieving it are coming with it. And that's somehow, I still don't hear any kind of contemporary dialogue that's willing to acknowledge that this is what's happening as a consequence of the way we're living right now.
Right.
We've nibbled around the edges about a word that you have a lot to say about. In fact, I think your view of catastrophe is unique, at least in my experience. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through a little bit of your thoughts about catastrophe?
Sure. But it's, just to be clear, it's not my view. It's not my opinion that this is what the word means. It's the faithful etymology of the word. So here we go. I'm going to sound like a school marm here, but you asked for it. So the word is made up of the prefix is Greek, and then the second part of the word is a very ancient Proto-Indo-European root, the Greek part. Kata, and as it's usually written in Greek, is a preposition, and it answers the question where, as many prepositions do, and then it gives you a sense of direction for this kind of movement. That's the first thing to notice, that the word catastrophe, in its old understanding, signals a kind of movement, not an event. Okay? So it's a certain proneness or tendency, and it says it goes down. But down not as in, you know, flush down the toilet, down. Not never-ending plummet and descent, you know, for no purpose. Because there's an intuition in there that it's also, by virtue of going down, you are entering something. So it's kind of down and in, which means there's a kind of subliminal understanding that this word cues you to. Something underneath the threshold of your awareness, of your willingness or your inclination. That's all in the first four letters. The second part of the word, strophe, people who've studied certain old English poetic forms and forms in other languages will come across this as a kind of technical phrase for either musical phrasing or poetic phrasing. Well, in fact, it's much older than that, and it's a very pragmatic word. Strophe comes from the practice of weaving or assembling or braiding. So think in terms then of a rope, R-O-P-E, and then think of a road, R-O-A-D, and you have the whole thing suddenly leap up before you. You put them back together, and what do you have? You have a way of going down and in to the deep mysteries of being a human being up in a particular time and place that you yourself didn't seek out, which is why we have that tone to the word catastrophe now, because we don't seek it out. And in a culture that believes utterly in personal mastery, then anything that comes to you unbidden is some kind of thing that should not have been. But the strophe part suggests that this way of going down and in has actually somehow been prepared for you before your moment came, meaning there's a way of going down that's actually there that you follow somehow, not because you want to, but because your life obliges you to, given your age or what your body's doing or the nature of a particular relationship or you open the newspaper and you read something for the first time and it hits you like it never done before, or you see the first leaf fall. We're talking on September 1st right now. The first leaves are going to fall, depending on where you live, fairly soon. And for the first time in your life, it looks like something else. All of these things have that sensibility to them, that the way into the mysteries of life are generally not chosen. The remarkable mercy of the arrangement is that whether you choose them or whether you don't, they're somehow available to you anyhow. That it's not left up to you to choose hardship or sorrow or heartbreak, but rather there's a way of entering into these things that's a pure sign that people have been there before you, an absolute trustworthy sign that even though you might go in that moment alone, but your aloneness is way overstated when you realize you're traveling a path. And that's kind of human contemplation is a kind of path in that sense. And the beauty of this arrangement is that if you keep up your end and your life obliges you down and into the mysteries, you will be doing your part to keep that little footpath through the forest of your days open for someone who you'll never meet coming after you, who is beset by trouble or hardship, thinks they're the only one, and halfway down the path that you yourself helped to clear, their head snaps to attention, and they suddenly realize, someone's been here before me. Mm. That may be a sign that there's some meant-to-be-ness in the presence of this thing instead of some utter calamity. Now, that's what catastrophe actually means. That's a tremendous power. And I think I've only done this twice. But, you know, I have a school, and it just hit me that the best way to declare myself in front of all these people at the school is to say, after having described, as I've just described to you now, the meaning of the word, I stood up in front of everybody with my arms open. I said, well, I am your catastrophe.
Nice.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that lesson in etymology. Mm-hmm. As teachers, we very frequently assume that a word means what everybody thinks it means, mm-hmm. without digging a little bit deeper. I think Mike has the final digging deeper question for us.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me that, you know, our living arrangement, so to speak, we think we represent humanity on some levels. And, you know, and I think what you've pointed out in this interview is we miss the being of being human. We're human, but we're not being. And you said that it's not human to fear death. It's not universal. But when a living arrangement believes it's humanity, it believes everybody experiences the world in the same way.
Sure.
And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that and give some insight to, you know, how cultures outside of this living arrangement treat death.
Did you say treat death?
Treat death.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first thing to say is I'm going to certainly get myself, if not you, into some consternation with other people now on this matter. But if we reserve the word culture for a certain kind of achieved, kind of sorrow-freighted understanding of our, you know, of the inevitability of us having real consequence to the world around us, but our willingness to live that and to somehow pull back when the cost becomes too high, if we reserve that word culture for that kind of sentient way of proceeding, do you think maybe it might behoove us to reserve the word human for something similarly achieved at the individual level?
Absolutely.
Because I'm saying yes.
I'm saying yes.
Here we
as
go
well.
Into some very murky water when
right.
we say it is not inevitable to be human as a consequence of being conceived and born. Now, you know, this is not just me talking. If you think of every culture that you've heard about, read about, perhaps even visited if you've been lucky enough, that's practicing some form of initiating of their teenagers at puberty, to take one common example, ask yourself, what do they understand themselves to be doing? And I submit to you that the answer is, they're trying to end the childhood of these kids to give them a chance to be, not adults, humans.
Right.
To give them a chance to be humans. Meaning that your childhood has to really be taken from you to give you a chance to live in a communal fashion that serves the idea of culture that I talked about a few minutes ago. Because if failure to end childhood results in the very arrangement that we've been talking about for the last hour, you could say that what we have instead of a culture is a consequence of, among other things, the utter unwillingness that we have to bring a forcible and choreographed and purposeful and mythically underwritten end to the childhood of the people we bring into the world who live among us. So I was obliged all the time in the death trade to, you know, to try to help 55-year-old adolescents die. And they didn't die very well because dying was not part of their plan for themselves. And that is exactly how an adolescent, a child, comes to their days, as they lead first with themselves and their needs and their wants and so forth. It's completely understandable. The problem is, it's not fitting beyond a certain age. Beyond a certain age, you can't be walking around with your hand out saying, "Where's mine?" And maybe one of the signs of the times that we're in, if these are end times, then so be it, they are, would be that basically, 25-year-olds and 55-year-olds are marauding the planet, their hands extended, demanding for and seeking basically the same things, the same kind of life partner, the same kind of, you know, payday, the same kind of total immersion for total transformation, you know, holiday, weekend where they fit in a little self-improvement on the side, and on and on and on. So, right. Well, you know, we do our kids a tremendous. Do we have to stop?
No, you can wrap up your answer. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I can't wrap up, of course.
No, I know.
This is just a lament. That's basically what you're hearing from me is that, you know, we were born into a time that doesn't believe in endings. It believes in possibilities. And that's a – well, I'll leave it at this. As a parent, you've or just as someone attending a young kid, you've probably taught somebody to ride a bike. And you know that kid never would have gotten on the bike if they didn't extract from you a blood oath to not let go of the seat. Now, you're going to betray that kid one of two ways. Either you're going to let go in order to give them the chance to learn how to ride, and you're going to betray, and they're going to fall, of course. Sure. And you will have betrayed them from their point of view, absolutely. And hopefully your relationship can somehow survive that betrayal. If, on the other hand, you keep your promise to not let go of the seat, the betrayal of that kid is ultimate, and there's nothing that survives that betrayal. And what I'm pleading for is the betrayal of the first kind, that we make certain promises knowing that they shouldn't be kept in order to get you into harm's way of life and for life to have its way with you. And maybe some of the things we've been talking about can come home to roost.
Absolutely. Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and the soul. Thank you, Stephen Jenkinson, for joining us today. I am enjoying the book. I'm learning a great deal from it.
Well, that's great. It's amazing how little you can do in an hour, isn't it?
It is, which means we'll eventually have to have you back.
This feels totally inadequate to me, but I hope it's some kind of beginning for the folks listening.
Absolutely.
Yes,
thank you so much.
On my behalf as well, Stephen. I appreciate it.
I appreciate the invitation, too. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Again, listeners, you can access information about Stephen Jenkinson at orphanwisdom.com.
Guy, you got a climate update.
I do, and it's quite extensive. California Climate Change Symposium was held in Sacramento last Monday and Tuesday, August 24th and 25th. The conclusion is reported by a headline in the August 25th edition of the Daily Breeze, quote, California climate researchers sound the alarm at symposium, there's no way out. Suzanne Moser, a leading Santa Cruz-based climate change researcher, was quoted in the article thusly, we need transformational change. We don't need more studies as much as we need to communicate the urgency. We need to not debate forever. What's this? A scientist claiming we don't need more study of an issue? Now that is stunning. Investigative journalist Li Fang, writing for The Intercept on August 25, 2015, uncovers a relationship between climate-denying lawyer Christopher Horner and big coal. Horner is an attorney who claims that Earth is cooling. He is known within the scientific community for hounding climate change researchers with relentless investigations and public ridicule, and he often derides scientists as communists and frauds. Horner is a regular guest on Fox News and CNN and has been affiliated with a number of think tanks and legal organizations over the last decade. He has called for investigations of climate scientists affiliated with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and NASA, and he has inundated climate researchers at major universities across the country with records requests that critics say are designed to distract the scientists from their work. New court documents reveal one source of Horner's funding, big coal. The recent bankruptcy filing of Alpha Natural Resources, one of the largest coal companies in America, includes line items for all of the corporation's contractors and grant recipients. Among them are Horner individually at his home address, as well as the Free Market Environmental Law Clinic, where he is a senior staff attorney. I'm going to take a break from the climate change doom here and read a limerick from the inimitable Benjamin the Donkey. It's titled Sleepy Time Prayer. I lay me down now with forewarning. Tomorrow will soon be a-borning. And of course it will suck, but with any kind of luck, I wake up dead in the morning. Okay, maybe that's not such a big break from the doom after all. Benjamin the Donkey posted that little ditty at the Near Term Human Extinction Support Group on Facebook. Back to doom. Earth might be headed for an ocean nearly devoid of life. As life arose on Earth, it arose from the ocean. So as the ocean goes, so do we. According to Robert Scribler's essay from August 28, 2015, shades of a Canfield ocean induced by hydrogen sulfide are evidenced by, quote, odd-smelling purple-colored waves appearing along the Oregon coastline that are a sign it may be starting to happen. That's Canfield Ocean event starting to happen. That's what he means by it. Scribbler quotes Peter Ward's book, Under a Green Sky, with this paragraph. Finally, we look out on the surface of the great sea itself, and as far as the eye can see, there is a mirrored flatness, an ocean without whitecaps. Yet that is not the biggest surprise. From shore to the horizon, there is but an unending purple color, a vast, flat, oily purple, not looking at all like water, not looking anything of our world. No fish break its surface, no birds or any other kind of flying creatures dip down looking for food. The purple color comes from vast concentrations of floating bacteria, for the oceans of Earth have all become covered with a 100-foot-thick veneer of purple and green bacterial soup.
Yuck.
Well, meanwhile, on a brighter note, the August 28, 2015 edition of Beach Connection attributes the purple waves to an abundance of a jellyfish-like creature called a salt. Considering the information to date comes from blogs and newspapers, I'd say the jury is still out on this one. And finally, on the climate change front, Jennifer Francis's once controversial work on the meandering jet stream was further validated in the August 31st, 2015 online issue of Nature Geoscience in an article titled Two Distinct Influences of Arctic Warming on Cold Winters Over North America and East Asia. Here's the bottom line, which contrasts sharply with the denier's view that snowballs are unusual along the eastern seaboard of the United States during the winter. Warming north of western Alaska creates colder winters in eastern and central North America. I've added this information to feedback number 19. So that's it for an extensive climate change update this week. And, of course, there will be more.
Woo, I'm exhausted.
You think you're exhausted? I had to write that and read it, and it's almost lethal for me.
Holy cow. All right, we have a Doomer of the Week this week, and it is Carl Klein. In response to a graphic image of a man feeding Earth into a chipper with dollar bills coming out of the exhaust, Carl writes, "I hope those dollars are edible." That's civilization for you, grinding Earth into ever smaller pieces in exchange for the illusion of wealth. And thanks, Lily from Phoenix, for researching and forward that tidbit. Lily, the flower in the desert, will be providing this service for future shows as well, with our thanks. And actually, that graphic reminds me of a little bit what Stephen was saying at the end when he was talking about culture is really kind of, and I don't know if you use the word earned, but really earning the fact of becoming human. It seems, Guy, that we are not human. We are actually conquerors rather than being human.
Well, yeah. In fact, recently for NatureBath Last, the blog, I put together a little video with the help of Colleen Schneider, our occasional guest host, and I pointed out that, in fact, war is the answer. We read on all the bumper stickers that war is not the answer. And then it occurred to me just last week that I was mistaken. War is not the answer. Conquest is the answer.
Right.
It's not really war at all if it's 1,000 to 1, if the odds are all stacked in our favor, if you have the world's largest military, in fact, you spend more for your military than the next 15 nations of the world combined, then maybe we should call it what it is. And what it is not a so-called fair fight.
No, absolutely. And, you know, and that really goes back to, at least for this particular country, our genesis with, you know, Columbus showing up, and as, you know, a story goes that I think is probably pretty representative of what actually happened, is when Columbus came ashore, he didn't actually recognize the people that were there because they were people. They were human beings, and of course conquerors don't recognize humans because they haven't been human in a long time. They're conquerors, and that's why they go out and they build ships in what we do today, and we call it peace. But, you know, call it what it is. It's really a form of conquering. There's a reason during the Super Bowl that they usually say, now we salute the men and women around the world in 180 bases around the world. There's a reason we're all around the world with our military. We're a conqueror's mentality. So.
Yes, absolutely. And without that mentality, we don't enjoy the privileges that we have in this country. And now, of course, it's a one-way street. Because if we stop the conquest, the lights go out. And this gets back to something Stephen Jenkinson was saying, that there's a different way to live. But almost everybody within North America would never believe that, would just assume that this is the only way to live, that the water coming through the taps and food at the grocery stores and fuel at the filling station, those are our rights.
Right.
How ludicrous
yeah,
is
it's,
that?
You're right. It's, you know, we've talked about this. This is why you and I and many of our listeners, we call this living arrangement a predicament, because we don't see that pattern. And if you cannot recognize the pattern, there is no hope for change if you don't know, if you don't realize a pattern even exists.
Yeah, and most people don't recognize the pattern. And if you point it out to them, they disparage you, for starters, right, for pointing it out. And or they don't even know what you're talking about. It's just a complete disconnect in terms of conversation.
Absolutely.
And I've had that online conversation hundreds of times, mm-hmm, where I point out that what we're doing is killing every aspect of the living planet, and people just don't even understand what I'm talking about. They assume I'm talking about going and living in a cave and sucking guts out of bugs.
Right.
Their interpretation of my suggestion that this isn't working all that well.
No, it's really a collective psychosis, and you know, we seem to be under that spell. And you know, we've talked a lot, obviously, in your work. Even if we did come to some sort of epiphany, it's a little too late for that, isn't it?
Yeah, just a little.
All right, folks. That about wraps it up this week. You make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, on the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions if you'd like to address them in the show. Next week, we're going to try to have some callers in. We'll have Forrest Palmer and Corey Morningstar along with we'll take some calls. And also, please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And Guy, why don't you mention a little bit about your book out with Pauline?
Yeah, the latest book just out within the last month, I guess, is called Ms. Ladybug and Mr. Honeybee, A Love Story at the End of Time. Interestingly, one of the neighbors at Coffee Today brought it up. She said she checked out the book and she was about halfway through it. And I said, oh, I'm sort of surprised it was there. I just gave it to the library a few days ago. And she said, and I wasn't the first person to check it out either.
Oh, well, right on.
Yeah, great. I said, so what do you think? You're about halfway through. And this is Dorothy, just so you know.
Okay. Yeah.
And she says, I guess I'm not enough of a child.
Way to sugarcoat it.
I said, tell me what you really think, Dorothy, and tell everybody else loudly in the room so they make sure they know what you're talking about.
We live in a doomer community. They just don't know it.
It just washes off of them.
Right. All right. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives on PRN.FM and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to Stephen Jenkinson for his work and his wisdom, and to Aprazin for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Right on.
Mother Nature.